Sir Alexander Glenn, reel 3.
Jack said, "You're a lucky guy. You're sitting on top of what is going to be one of the crucial supply routes in this war, the northern sea route to Russia." He said, "I know Persia backwards. The Persian railways just can't take even a trickle of what is going to be required. And realize, don't call me lucky, you're far luckier than me in what is going to happen in the northern seas." So, as first go, Einar said, "For God's sake, can't we even stay behind as a small commander force? I mean, say, ten of you chaps. As it happened on the expedition, there were three who had been on expeditions with me in peacetime days. Chap Dan Godfrey, who was a sapper colonel, Herbert Carrington Smith, who was a Canadian sapper, and Eric Greenwood. So we attempted to persuade the military force commander was Chap Potts, a Canadian general, who really was about the dumbest guy I've ever met in my life. His first retort was that we would be eaten by the Eskimos, and so we explained there were no Eskimos, and he pointed at the Norwegians and said, "Well, aren't they Eskimos?" We appealed to Vian, who was very dismissive. It was unlike him, it was untypical of him, because that sort of venture, you know, he usually went with. And so, in fact, very, very disappointed, we returned to Greenock. And this was, mid-September. Now, about by that time, in London, was a very remarkable Norwegian character called Hilmer Reksten. He was a ship owner, and he also was a very large shareholder in the Norwegian mines, and in fact was chairman of the company employing Sverdrup. Sverdrup was put in jail as we arrived back on an MI5 belief that he'd participated in the sending back to Norway of a small ship from Spitsbergen involving, I think, the shooting of 4 or 5 Norwegians by the Germans. Well, I think there probably was something in that, but it was, I can't comment at first hand, but maybe. Reksten, we got Sverdrup out of jail within a couple of days. That involved Charles Hambro, who, of course, was chairman of SOE at that moment. They were head of director of SOE at that moment. That was fortuitous, because we immediately nobbled him, really effectively giving the Jack Sverdrup message. And Charles said, "Well, something in that." Now, here was an interesting case of what I mentioned earlier, I think, that Norwegian government, Norwegian naval staff, Norwegian military staff, all well organized in London, respected, in position. So Admiral Riiser-Larsen, who had been to the North Pole and with Amundsen, was chief of naval staff at that moment. He backing came in at once. The Air Force commander. And relations again between Norwegian naval staff and Admiralty, absolutely first rate, you know. So I should think within days we had general agreement between Admiralty and Norwegian general staff in London that, yes, a mistake had been made, that we should have some kind of holding force in Spitsbergen. How to get it there? And what should it consist of? Well, it had to be small. And of course, at that time, the war shipping losses were pretty awful. So on condition that two very small Norwegian ships were used, one a 50-year-old icebreaker from Oslo Harbour, the Isbjørn, and a wooden hunting ship, the Salis, 5 knots, speed, black smoke belching from funnels. If we were prepared to take the risk, Admiralty would bless it. And there's a very interesting, unexpected sequence of events comes out of all this. But it was agreed we must fly some kind of reconnaissance off Spitsbergen prior to this. It was only fair. I mean, okay, we're a volunteer force, but we're going to go into the total unknown. Of course, Bletchley by that time were picking up the intercepts that there was a small German landing ground and meteorological stations working, which were suitably wordy to us that there was reason to believe there might be German activity. So Coastal Command came in. Air Chief Marshal Sir Philip Joubert and his Chief of Staff, Air Vice Marshal Baker, enthusiastic because they were just getting the first deliveries of the Catalinas. And up to that time, there'd been no aircraft capable of that range. A 1,200 miles return flight, 2,400 miles. But much, much more important, that the RAF had no experience in high-altitude flying and navigation at all. They had done none. Their charts ended at 70 degrees north. Compass effects, icing, etc., 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 unknown. So, Hood, of course, had been sunk Bismarck Straits by that time. And the significance, while the convoys to North Russia had been sailed the first winter in winter darkness without much interference, and really at that moment the Germans, I think, were so confident of early victory on the Russian front that they said, what the hell, you know, it isn't going to make any difference. By spring, after the Russian winter defense, German attention to that route was altering very quickly. The first deployments of the up to Banach were underway, and the heavy, some of, I think Hipper had already moved north. Maybe one of the Tirpitz was due to very shortly. So your scenario suddenly was of, yes, here is a new strategic area. Air Force Coastal quickly said, well, we'll give you 1 hour, we'll give you one Catalina. Keep the crew together. We regard this as development flights, learning flights. The captain of the aircraft, Flight Lieutenant Healy, was given total authority by CNC, Coastal Command, to make any demands upon any RAF station unit without explanation. I don't think this has ever been given to an individual captain of an aircraft before. And PQ and 210 Squadron was chosen. The aircrew committed, and I became a member of that aircrew, but also with my responsibilities to the Norwegian force as well. In fact, I don't quite know who I was with. I was being shuttling around. I'm flying one day and naval staff the next day. By that time, Admiralty had taken over responsibility from SOE for the operation, quite amicably. I mean, I don't mean in any takeover method, primary responsibility, and very wisely done, lay with the Norwegian High Command. So the Norwegian, here was a Norwegian operation, flying operations coastal, so British, and three British liaison officers attached to that force. Godfrey, as I've mentioned before, very obviously, myself. And here comes an interesting turn, because I said that, very beginning, that in 1935-36 we did some ionosphere research in the high Arctic. It was the first time it had been done. Appleton had just been appointed scientific advisor to the government. We were getting... he knew that naval communications in the far north would suffer from periodic interferences, cause of which was still a little bit uncertain. They were beginning to know more about that. Appleton saw the planning paper of the first forthcoming Norwegian operation to Spitsbergen. Appleton, in a matter of something like 3 weeks from citing this planning paper, had a very much improved ionosphere unit constructed, whipped Colonel Watman out of the Royal Corps of Signals, who carried out the ionosphere work in Spitsbergen 4 years before, had him appointed as a third of the British liaison officers, and off we went in these two little ships with this pretty sophisticated equipment, really unknown to anyone, tucked in. Well, we had 1,200 miles to go. We had flown, by the way, the two reconnaissances, which showed no German forces in strength in Spitsbergen. These were 24-hour minimum, 24-hour to 32-hour sorties, flown by Healy. I accompanied both of them. And we sailed, the Norwegian force and the two little ships sailed from Iceland on the 1st of May 1942. 1,200 miles to go, creeping along the ice edge, and they were not spotted, despite the tremendous frequency of German meteorological flights at that time. They got within 2 miles of their objective, which was 1,200 miles. They got within 2 miles. Spitsbergen was icebound, and we were breaking ice. 2 miles, we'd reached within 2 miles of the coast when we were clobbered by four Fokker Wolfs from Trondheim, who'd picked one of the German Met flights had picked us up that morning. We were already within reach of land. Sverdrup made a very serious mistake that moment. A curious sort of trauma came over him, that he was back in Spitsbergen, that all was well, we'd reached our objective. Dan Godfrey said, "For God's sake, land your chaps. You know, we get arms ashore, they can carry as much as possible, because I just don't believe in continuation of this good luck," and he wouldn't listen to it. Watman and I, meanwhile, went off on the ski reconnaissance, and then that evening at midnight, the four Fokker Wolfs hit. And, of course, I'll show you later, I've got all the photographs taken by them, by the way, of that attack, which was about 10 minutes, you know, the direct hits at once. Sverdrup and Godfrey were killed, direct hit of the ship. Watman and I, we were all standing together. We, I think, must have been, the blast blew us, I think, onto the main deck, and it must have pulled the other two back. So we got onto the ice with 40 other survivors, and Fokker Wolfs kept up the attack, bombing and cannon attack, for 20 minutes probably. But being bombed on the sea ice, they were kept very low level, and the bombs were bouncing, because they were... So, lining yourself up, you had about 10 seconds or so to go left or right. Out of the 45, I think, survivors on the ice, I think only two were wounded by four Fokker Wolfs at 200 feet, that sort of thing, over 20 minutes, which was really quite encouraging. I lost my glasses, one of these. They were blown off. And they were blown back by a second bomb, which, because the bombs were exploded under the ice. So up it was coming.
Blew your glasses into the ice?
Yeah, well, I don't know where they went, but about 2 weeks later, it was a sort of second attack. Then we got everyone ashore, and there was enough to eat, no particular hardships. What was vital at that moment was the tremendous morale of these Norwegian survivors. They were bloody well home, and they weren't going to be shoved out by anyone. They lost their skis, but there were quite a number of skis in the old Russian coal mine. So we got them. There were 30 dead pigs that we'd killed the year before, and we'd remembered where they were, so we'd plenty of, we'd very good pork. We lived all right. Question was, would we be picked up? And of course, remember, we did not know Fletcher at that moment. Of course, signals had been decrypted that night. But we had, in fact, with Healy and the Catalina crew, we had done an emergency kind of thinking ahead, you know. What happens if? What will we do that? Healy was sent out 10 days later, and we made contact absolutely as we had discussed. I mean, he came, started his search about 50 miles away from where we were, not bad. And got me the signals across, because at that moment, Admiralty had thought that they would have to evacuate us, you know, at once. And one message back was, we're here to stay. We'll take it out by force if necessary. Well, we want the guns. We can beat these guys here. And he then carried out this very remarkable series of 4 24-hour flights to Spitsbergen in 10 days. He brought up arms a second time, Tommy guns, light brands, and blankets, that sort of thing, landed his aircraft in the ice. Sea ice was just breaking up, but he landed on the second flight, took off our, got our 11 Norwegian wounded into the aircraft, with a collapsible boat, not altogether easy. Then fourth flight took me back to London, where Admiralty had already set up planning staff, and end of June, HMS Cumberland and two fleet destroyers came up with major reinforcements, 3 3-inch guns, a new force commander, splendid chap, Captain Ulring, Royal Norwegian Navy, already DSO, and about 90 Norwegian commandants. We landed 130 tons of ammunition, supplies, etc., with open boats, in a matter, I think it was something like 3 hours. It wasn't bad doing, without a pier, and onto a coast. And Ulring then kept command of Spitsbergen for the next 14 months. Ionosphere station was worked. We put it in one of the coal mines because there are level adits to the mines above sea level. They're about 600 feet above the sea, above sea level. Perfect place. And he had this this unit worked away very happily. I think the most dramatic part was because by that time, of course, the Germans had extensive meteorological stations over the Arctic. They were being picked up one by one in Greenland. A few were in ships which were sunk in North Greenland Sea. But Ulring reckoned that we had to rustle them up, scare the daylights out of them as much as possible. His first activity was to take his U-boat moor it, if I take his motorboat, 18 feet motorboat, moor it behind an island and wait for German aircraft. And he shot down two that way. Then he got more ambitious. He wanted to sink a U-boat. And his theory was, if he had a white tablecloth, he would put it over his motorboat and pretend to be a piece of ice, and then lob a hand grenade down the conning tower. That didn't work quite so well, because the U-boat commander, a little bit brighter than he was, and in fact he lobbed a shell over and sank Ulrich's motorboat. But that was all right, he was picked up. And Captain HMS Sheffield, who did the next supply run, in his report of proceedings, states that I left Captain Ulrich, who I believe was in the habit of hunting U-boats with a tin opener, I left him two depth charges because I thought that would make it a bit easier. Ulrich was absolutely magnificent. So Spitzbergen was held, and the German stations, more and more they went to increasingly remote places, and relied increasingly on automatic stations and not manned ones. A commentary on that was given by the head of the German Meteorological Services at the time of the Ardennes offensive, when he was asked to forecast a period of 6 days of snow, bad weather and fog in the Ardennes. And his reply was that due to Allied interruption of our meteorological service network in the Arctic, the longest forecast I can give, and that is stretching it, is 3.5 days. So significance was quite good. The other part, of course, was that it kept... we believed at that time that the Germans would establish landing strips in Spitzbergen so that the torpedo bombers could refuel Spitzbergen, do shuttle bombing of the convoys. And it certainly discouraged that. But I'm bound to say I doubt very much whether they ever intended to do that logistically. And they had everything in Banach. Why establish a further base over relatively 400 mile channel of water? It would seem to me to have been really counterproductive. So I doubt if that was ever seriously intended. But the most interesting climax of this whole operation was September 1943, a year and a half later, when quite suddenly HMS Tirpitz, Scharnhorst, Lützow, and I think 6 or 7 fleet destroyers made a dash from North Norway to Spitzbergen, entered Icefjord, shelled the Norwegian main garrison, Barentsburg, went on to Longyear, where they had a minor station, shelled it, landed a company of Brandenburg grenadiers. Most of the Norwegians, of course, just withdrew into the hills. They captured, 12-15 Norwegians. One British, Watman's successor, Lieutenant Watson, who was still operating the ionosphere station. They missed the station in the coal mine entrance. They never saw it. And so, and then, slap happy, back to North Norway, full speed, on this extraordinary operation, which made no naval sense at all. I was that day due to leave for Yugoslavia, was whipped, picked up by an Admiralty car at about 2 a.m. driven to, taken to Northolt, taken by Hudson up to Shetland, in a Catalina, to chase, try to intercept this force going back. What we would have done when we intercepted them, thank you very much. Anyway, we never saw them. But we did fly over Barentsburg. We saw the extent of the damage, and we saw the Norwegians returning down the hills, and we dropped a message, I think, you know, good luck, chums, and that. But this quite extraordinary naval venture. Now, there is one possible explanation to it. I believe it was the anniversary of the Kiel Mutiny in 1917. And whether Hitler decided he would prefer to have had his ships at sea for any purpose on that day, I think is the only rational explanation of it. But in short, this tiny Norwegian operation, I'd like to call it that, because it was theirs. At very in the heart of enemy air and sea space, after all, very difficult to supply, and no ships were lost, by the way, in the supply, held the place for until the end of the war, certainly seriously interrupted the German meteorological work. The one casualty, peculiarly tragic, was our early Catalina aircraft with Flight Lieutenant Healy, which on his very, very last flight from Murmansk to Spitsbergen was intercepted by Ju-88, and the only casualty was Healy himself. He already had been awarded an immediate DSO for what must be one of, in sustained operation, really one of the outstanding feats of the Air Force. But the other great contribution they made was to the knowledge of polar flowering and polar navigation in wartime. So on a cheap operation, because it was that, cheap and cheeky, I think, in every sense, it was quite a high dividend for, apart from the initial sinking of the ships, a very small investment. It is, I believe, the highest decorated small operation of the war. I can give you a list of the British and Norwegian decorations. The two sergeant Norwegian sergeant majors, Richard Knudsen, Ersby, Mellaby, who, I mean, they were like rocks of Gibraltar. Nothing worried them. They got either CGMs or DSMs. I think three DSOs were given, Norwegian War Cross. Altogether, I think something like 25 or 26, we must count it up, decorations were awarded. It's still very much a treasured part of Norwegian life. There's an anniversary due at the War Memorial, War Museum in Akershus. Not every year, but about every two or three. I go almost every time, and, you know, our numbers are getting a wee bit more thin. But it's very, very moving, because these chaps were not soldiers, they were coal miners.
Before we leave the Arctic, can I go back to the 30s when you did that work in 35-36?
Certainly.
I think you said, on the ionosphere. Do I understand that this was something instigated by Watson Watts?
Yes, it was.
As a method of developing his ideas of radar?
Yes, yeah.
Could you tell me more about
absolutely,
the detail?
Absolutely.